Just a quick overview statement. You know, we have a team that is just following the zinc industry in extreme detail full time, and not just in Toronto where our commodity consultants, internal commodity consultants are based, but you know, people in Shanghai who spend the bulk of their time analyzing what's going on in that country and what zinc production is coming on, could come on, or is not coming on. And we believe that one of the major commodity consultants out there has significantly overestimated the supply that's coming on, and that's one of the big differences in our view of the zinc market. And it would appear that many in the financial markets have relied on that estimate, but I guess we'll find out in the next 6 months whether it's right or not. But certainly what we're seeing is it's not close to right. But with that as an overview comment, Andrew, do you have any more thoughts on zinc?
Yeah, I think, Brad, again, when you look at the terminal exchanges, stock exchanges, LME has gone up. But again, some of that is hidden stocks that are reappearing onto the LME. But the market today is still a backwardated market. So, again, the backwardated market means that the market physically is still firm. If it was a long market, then the backwardation would probably be eliminated. And even with the increases in the LME on occasion, it's still a backwardated market. And when we look at the Shanghai exchanges on the other side, it's down over 20%. So material has been basically displaced from other traditional markets and gone into the China market as the demand is continues to be strong there. Smelters are operating at low utilization rates, as I mentioned. So the demand in China is firm. There's just not enough metal supply because due to the tightness in the concentrate market. So metal inventories are declining in China. There is some blips in the LME terminal stocks, but that is still some of the hidden stocks coming out of the woodwork. But overall, it's a firm market. We're at 9 days of global consumption. So, again, well below the historical long-term average of over 20 days. So we're still running at very low metal inventories, and the concentrate market, as I mentioned, is at historically low levels on treatment charges. And to your question on what are the quality of these materials coming into the marketplace on new production, some of them are the reclaimed tailings, and this will be something new to the marketplace, which has not experienced processing reclaimed tailings to the extent that it appears onto the marketplace. So the market for concentrates is still going to be tight in the near term. So there's this new additional material coming on is required. It's still not sufficient to meet the demand growth rates.
And just one other factor. I mean, there has been no let up in China's commitment to environmental standards, much higher environmental standards. And if anything, they're getting stricter on that. So that has had a big, big impact on potential mine zinc production in China. We just don't think it's going to materialize like some of the others do. But I guess that's what makes a market, a difference of views.
Very helpful. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. The next question is from Oscar Cabrera from CIBC. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator. Good morning, everyone. If we could get back to just QB2. The objective to ultimately hold 60 to 70% interest, was that, trying to diversify risk from the project or and then participate in other projects in the copper space later on, or is it more the current market that we are seeing now and the possibility of slower demand if the trade wars escalate?
So I want to be very clear on this, Oscar, because we saw your report and we know that you didn't get a chance to call us first before writing it. But the current market conditions have nothing to do with us making the decision to seek a partner on QB2. I repeat, absolutely nothing to do, no effect whatsoever. This is a long-term project, as I said, a 100-year resource, and short-term market volatility short to medium-term kind of volatility in price does not affect these long-term investment decisions. We're making decisions that are more than 50 years, so it has no impact whatsoever. We just believe that given the experience the industry has had over the last 10 to 15 years, putting all your eggs in one $5 billion basket isn't really the prudent thing to do. Bringing on a partner will only strengthen the project, whichever kind of partner we bring on, whether it be a financial partner, a market and a concentrate related partner, or an operating construction related partner. And that's a good thing for QB2 long term and a good thing for Teck long term. It does free up quite a bit of financial resources, certainly $2 billion U.S. or more for us to do other things. And as I said, that could start with capital returns to shareholders or reducing debt more or any of the other projects that we have. And we do have a long list. But again, I want to emphasize that that decision has nothing to do and shouldn't have anything to do with current market volatility.
Okay, no, that's really clear. Thank you, Don. Then in terms of, you know, you're about 70% complete on engineering. Have you seen anything that would lead you to believe that the, I believe it was $4.8 billion U.S. could be reduced?
I'll turn that over to, I guess, Alex Christopher or Dale Anders, whoever wants to take it. We're in the final strokes there. I will highlight is the exchange rate of the Chilean peso that you choose, and that's been variable, shall we say, in the last 6 to 12 months, just as the Canadian dollar has. So the nameplate number that we end up publishing will be affected by that. But, Alex, you want to start?
Yeah, certainly. Thanks for the question, Oscar. I guess a couple things here to point out. As we advance engineering, you know, one of the key things we're doing here is reducing the exposure risk with respect to all of our estimates around pricing of contracts and labor productivity. As we go through our procurement cycle, we're getting firm numbers in from the companies that we're letting the equipment out to. So you know, we've certainly reduced the risk of that capital number moving from on an upward basis, and really that's the benefit of getting the advancement in the engineering and out into the market with respect to procurement. With respect to reducing the cost, we continue to focus on a variety of things, including our estimates of labor productivity in the field, and are working hard with the major contractors that we're going out to RFP to bid on the major contracts in terms of improving on productivity estimates to maintain the capital number or bring it down. And we see that as the place where we're going to see the best chance at reducing the overall capital price.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. And then lastly, on switching over to steelmaking coal, on the Mackenzie Red Cap, 1.4 million tons over 9 years, could you give us an idea of the scope of the project in terms of capital expenditures, and can you remind me what the what your capacity is on your processing facilities?
Okay, I'll just turn that over to Robin Sharmeta, but just to remind you that that 1.4 million tons would be over and above the current capacity that we're aiming for from the Elk Valley mines of 27 million tons. So, Robin?
Okay, as far as capacity, the Cardinal River plant has capacity for about 1.8 million per year. So that's the nameplate on the plant. And then as far as capital, I think to be fair, it's still at a feasibility stage. We're still trying to establish what the total capital costs are, but it's actually quite a capital efficient project for us. If you looked at any of our expansion opportunities, it's one of the top ones. So I think that's probably where we'd like to leave the capital estimate right now.
Would it be comparable to what we were talking about with Quintet?
It would be quite a bit less because it is a brownfield expansion. It's really the mining part. There's not a whole lot to do beyond that. We just need to construct an access out to that area of the operation. There's not a whole lot of extra equipment to bring that online. So it's quite a bit more capital efficient than Quintet would be.
Yeah, no, that would be order of magnitude less. I just wanted to clarify that QB2's engineering is 70% complete, not 30%, as I think was said.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The following question is from Lucas Spice from B. Riley FBR. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning, everybody, and thank you for taking my question. I also appreciate the clarity on seeking a partner for QB2, and I really want to follow up on just the previous question. Don, at various times it appeared as if you would be happy to go ahead alone. If I think back, for example, to the analyst day, and what changed? I would really appreciate your perspective on that. I think it makes a ton of sense, but I would appreciate kind of what changed in your thinking.
I wouldn't say anything actually changed. What I would say is that the board has had a thorough discussion of the balance of risks and made their decision to be as prudent as possible on this project. Look, if you've been in the business a long time, you know how hard it is to get a hold of a nice, clean, doable project in a decent geopolitical jurisdiction that has a really long life. Mine life to payback ratios of in excess of 10 or something. So to get a hold of that is really, really tough. Is just ask any of the other, you know, competing companies that are in the industry. It's tough to find one, and we've got one. So you are tempted to keep it all and do it all. But we also have several other alternatives, and we do want to ensure that shareholders get good returns on a capital return basis, and that we have debt at nice, you know, low levels for the long term in an increasingly volatile world. So when you're balancing all those factors, eventually the board makes a decision. And this will free up, you know, in the order of $2 billion U.S. or more in terms of capital required going forward. So completely changes the picture going forward and gives us flexibility to do something else. We could still end up with the same total copper production increase over a 3 or 4 year period. But just having it in two different sources, perhaps two different countries, two different operational or construction risks, and that just makes a stronger company overall. So that's the board's decision. We haven't done it yet, of course, but we certainly see an awful lot of interest. So as we've said, we think we can go through the process from now till the end of the year and announce a transaction.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And then On Neptune, I wanted to follow up on the expansion project there, and I wanted to ask kind of what is the potential minimum amount of volumes that you could or would have to ship through Westshore once that Neptune expansion is completed?
I think that will depend at the time on what the alternative options are, but suffice it to say that we're going to have a lot of capacity there, and if you know, competing options are not appropriate economics, then we can put an awful lot through Neptune. I think, I mean, we've announced different sort of nameplates and things, but it's going to give us a lot of flexibility. And remember, the key reason for doing this is it gives us long-term, low-cost, and flexible capacity, so we can count on our coal being delivered into the market, particularly when prices are high. And so this is just going to make that whole business a lot stronger.
Got it. Thank you for that. And the competing options that you mentioned, would that be could you elaborate on that?
Well, right now we ship essentially through Westshore, Neptune, and Ridley, and you know, the mix of how many tons go where will change once the Neptune project is launched.
Got it. And then and maybe one last one for Real. Just following up on the drop in met coal prices, Real, what would you attribute that to? Is it some of the macro concerns or maybe more specifically related to weaker demand in China or supply growth? I would really appreciate your perspective, and also if you could comment on what you think is the kind of best estimate for an equilibrium price in your steelmaking coal. I would appreciate your thoughts. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Lucas. Well, maybe the first thing to say is demand in the market remains really, really strong. So even if you look at global crude steel production June year to date, it's up nearly 5%. And that's in all areas of the world. That's a global increase. But China is up 6%, India is up over 5%, and the rest of the world is up 3%. So as you can see, the global demand remains strong.
In terms of what we're seeing on our side, customers are continuing to request additional tons, and that reflects really that stronger demand that we see on the coal side and on the steel side. With respect to pricing, yes, pricing has corrected. It is a function of, we believe, the uncertainty around tariffs and also potential for trade war. But the price of coal is still pretty close to the long-term average of around $180. This morning, the average of the three assessments are above $172. And the average for the quarter to date, lagged by a month, is sitting over 192. So it is still, by all means, very decent pricing for steelmaking coal.
Particularly in Canadian dollars, where it's close to 230.
Yeah. Great. Gentlemen, I really appreciate all the color. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Piyush Sood from Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. A couple of questions from me. On Galore Creek, I just want to understand that, let's say the project gets approved, would you be 50-50 partners, and will you also get an offtake of the precious metal side, or is it possible to imagine a scenario where, based on some economics, you keep the copper and Newmont keeps gold and silver, something like that?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, it's an interesting question. I would say it's a little premature in that we're going to be working with Newmont for the next 3 years. We have an agreed plan to redo the pre-feasibility, as we discussed, and at that time, then, you know, we'll make decisions on how to go forward. But we're delighted to have Newmont as a partner. Gary Goldberg and I work very closely together on different industry issues, and I think it's just a great partnership, really, really good culture fit. And could long-term we end up streaming gold one way and copper the other? That's, of course, a possibility, but, you know, it's something that I think we'd think about literally probably not for about 4 years at the earliest. We need to get through the work that we've agreed to do, but it's still an exciting development. It just makes Galore Creek like a very real option for the long-term. And that's exciting for us because it's right here in BC as well. So we're very, very pleased with that announcement today.
No, that's fair. Thank you. And also, the press release mentions a letter from the U.S. Commissioners of International Joint Commission on Water Quality. Could you talk a little bit more about it?
Yeah, I think probably the best person to answer that would be Patrick Smith, or Senior Vice President of Sustainability and External Affairs.
Sure. Happy to take the question. As we've said over the last few weeks, it is disappointing that members of the U.S. Joint International Commission claim that they lack information on water quality in the Elk Valley. In fact, I think as people on this call know, there have been massive amounts of data, numerous studies made available about the potential impacts of selenium on water quality, and I think the issue is very well understood by both regulators and stakeholders on both sides of the border. This is a complex legacy issue caused by many decades of mining, and that is why we are working to address those issues. We're working closely with regulators here in British Columbia, with Canada and in the U.S., and we are in the process of investing significant funds to treat water quality, and ultimately our view is that the plan we put in place is one of the most comprehensive of its kind ever developed. So we're making good progress, I think we're on track to get our water treatment facilities up and running this fall. So that's really where the issue stands at this point.
So at this point, you're probably doing more R&D on the saturated rock fill site technology. So you think eventually maybe costs actually go down versus what we previously heard from you?
Yeah, we're pretty excited about this. I'm going to ask Robin Schiarmento to talk about saturated Rockville.
You bet. I love talking about saturated Rockville. We've got, at this stage, a very successful pilot in process. In fact, we're managing to treat now, we're approaching 10,000 cubic meters a day. We're seeing 95 to 100% removal of selenium out of the water from the saturated Rockville at Elkview. And I'll just put that in perspective. That's almost double the capacity of what we will have operating at West Lion Creek when our plant comes back online here shortly. So far it is an extraordinarily positive pilot, and we do anticipate this will be a part of our long-term strategy now on water treatment.
And possible effects on capital required?
Yeah, briefly, if you take a 20,000 cubic meter a day plant, just for reference, it would cost in around $300 million to construct. The saturated rock fill would cost roughly $50 million to construct at that same level of capacity. And then on an operating basis, a 20,000 cubic meter a day plant would run at roughly $22 million a year operating costs, and a saturated rock fill would be about half that, so around $10 million a year. So big difference.
Well, clearly we're very, very excited about the potential, but we will have to finish sort of confirmation of the results there and make sure the regulators and so on fully understand it before it becomes part of the long-term plan. But, clearly very, very positive development.
Great. Thanks, guys. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. The next question is from Jeremy Sussman from Clarksons. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks very much for taking my question. I think, Don, last quarter you sort of were pretty clear in terms of noting your priority for QB2 over Quintet. I'm curious if the decision to sell down a stake in QB2 changes anything for the potential for Quintet to move ahead.
That's a very good question. My initial sort of response is not really, but I think it's a fair question in that it certainly frees up a lot of capital for us to be able to do other things, one of which could be Quintet. But the principles that I probably talked about last time remain the same, that we are working longer term to rebalance the portfolio. We obviously are a little bit overweight steelmaking coal, not that we don't like the business. It's proving to be one of the very best mining businesses in the world. And so we like that. And we're seeing strong demand, as Rael talked about. And we had a lot of requests from customers in India and so on to reopen Quintet. So I do think at some point that it will make sense to do so. But right now we've, committed to our shareholders that growth in copper is getting the priority. And, the strategy of the company is quite simple. We're taking strong cash flows from coal and strong cash flows from zinc and devoting it to doubling our copper business. To the extent that we're not going to put all of our eggs in one $5 billion basket on QB2 because we just think it's more prudent to diversify a bit, and that frees up as much as $2 billion U.S. to do something else, I still think that copper would take priority for some time, but you never know. So, and that's a decision that, we wouldn't be looking at deploying any extra capital, I would think, for at least a year. You'd want to see QB2 up and running smoothly, in terms of its construction, up and running smoothly before you decided to commit capital to other growth projects, one of which could be Quintet. But during that year, we're going to see several, milestones, including the full feasibility on Zafranal, the pre-feasibility on St. Nicholas, and so on. So it's going to be a very interesting year. Fair question. I'm not sure I gave you that clear an answer, but at least you get a feel for how we think about it.
Well, that was actually a super helpful answer. And maybe just as my follow-up, obviously, QB2 and Quellaveco are both, world-class projects. One of the two just sold down a further 22% stake for $600 million. Curious if you have a thought on valuation there.
Yeah, I think depending on future payments, you'd get a number even higher than that. We see a lot of comparability between the two projects. We literally do, I don't know if we call it apples to apples, but a direct comparison line by line on the different aspects of the two projects. And, they have a little bit higher production in the early years because of higher grade, but QB2 has more consistent over the life, and you know, a whole bunch of, like, we have much lower strip ratios. All-in sustaining costs are really good. We're going to be going out to the market, Canada, U.S., and Europe, once the project's sanctioned, with very detailed presentations on all elements of QB2 and comparing to what else is out there. So, you know, we can't predict what the valuation is going to be, and the world will, you know, evolve between now and when that will happen in Q4 that will have an effect. But we do see a lot of comparability between the two projects.
Agreed. Thanks very much, and good luck.
Thank you.
John, I think we've gone over a little bit here. Got time for one more question.
Thank you. So the last question for today will be from Mark Levin from Seaport Global Securities. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Just two very quick questions. One has to do with capital structure, and maybe if you have some updated thoughts about what you think will look like or looks like the best capital structure for the business going forward, you know, particularly given QB2 and the decision that you made to find a partner.
Okay, I'll ask Ron Mills first to start just on our basic ratios, and then I maybe have some additional comments.
Yeah, so our basic ratios, debt equity ratio, we'd like to see that somewhere in the 20% to 30% range, and the debt to EBITDA, the leverage test, we'd like to be in that sort of 2 to 2.5 times. On occasion, we'll exceed that, depending on the opportunities in front of us and where commodity prices are. But if we sort of get to those levels, we think that will be certainly helpful to get back to an investment grade credit rating.
Got it.
Yeah, and so what I wanted to add to that is that the structure of your outstanding debt is really important too in terms of your maturity ladder and balanced against how much liquidity you keep on. So we said that we're going to have close to $7 billion of liquidity, and this is before any entry fee into QB2, and that compares to no debt due for the rest of 2018, no debt due in 2019, no debt due in 2020, and only $220 million debt due in 2021. So $7 billion of liquidity with only $200 million of debt coming due in 3 years' time. So during the time that we would be building, we would have, you know, a really, really strong position. So the total debt outstanding is one thing, and we could still reduce that, but the maturity ladder, the timetable of our maturities, is really, really important to us, and that's why we've structured it the way it is.
Yeah, that makes sense. One last question, which I think I know the answer before I ask, but I'll try anyway. With the realizations, the Mid-Coal price realizations this quarter kind of return back to more normal levels, I'm assuming because the spreads weren't as wide during the quarter, but obviously the quarter before that, it had kind of blown out. Any preliminary ideas right now if this, where you were this quarter with a met coal price realization relative to the benchmark is more likely in Q3 or something that looks more like it did in Q1?
Yeah, so on this one, we have made a decision not to focus on the percent realized price versus benchmark because it became clear that it was highly misleading to the market, the people who were focusing on that number. The reality is that it depend that if we ever put a number out there, it is only good for a moment in time. And we found that people were sort of putting that into their models and leaving it there when really you need to pay attention to the daily the trade journals who publish a coal price index every day and look at the difference between high quality hard coking coal and then the lower quality products that are out there and see what the spreads were. It is true that the percent realization number, if you did the calculation, which we're not going to do anymore, was wider last time because in the market there was a significant difference in demand for high quality versus low quality, and those spreads widened quite significantly. In this quarter, they've gone back more to normal. Nothing has changed in terms of the coal that's in the ground. It is what it is, and in the long term, if you just took normalized pricing spreads, about 92% is where we end up. We were, I think, 93% this time, but I'm trying to forget what those numbers are because it's more important to just look at the day-to-day numbers.
I understand that. That makes sense. And then finally, last question for Rial has to do with Chinese buying patterns in the met coal market. The yuan has obviously had a pretty significant move. Even I think the rupee in India, is the currency has moved a lot. Have you seen in the market less of an interest from either Chinese or Indian buyers, potentially as a function of currency more than anything?
Oh, interesting question, Mark. The Chinese imports of steelmaking coal from seaborne market are down this year compared to last year, but India is running very, very strong, and that is where we see the most growth going forward. There's still the government plan for crude steel production is still to increase to 300 million tons of capacity by 2030-2031. That's compared to around 120 to 125 million tons currently. So there is still very strong demand in that market. In Eastern Europe, with the depletion of mines, they're relying more on seaborne market. We're also seeing growth in Southeast Asian markets. So we need to look at market as a whole as opposed to market by market.
Fair enough. Thank you guys very much.
Okay, well, let me just make a closing comment. And to repeat, we think it was an extraordinary quarter, solid earnings of $650 million, and a record first half for the company of $1.4 billion earnings. We've increased guidance on each of the zinc, copper, and coal businesses. We've got the QB2 partner process getting started, which should free up as much as $2 billion U.S. from future capital requirements. We've got the permitting almost done in QB2, and there's real scarcity value in QB2 in terms of projects out there. The Fort Hills startup could not have been better. Really got a fantastic plant there. Suncor doing a great job. The Waneta transaction closes today, $1.2 billion more cash. Newmont coming in as a partner in Glore Creek. That is fantastic. And we've got all sorts of catalysts coming in the next 6 to 12 months, so we're feeling great here. Look forward to talking to you after Q3. Thanks very much.
Thank you. The conference has now ended. Please disconnect your line at this time. We thank you for your participation.